There have been many violent rebellions in American history. Most Americans are familiar with the Civil War, of course, and virtually every state has some version of violent struggles for control of governance, lands, and resources in its history, and that includes Oregon. It also includes Jackson County. Today, my two guests will help us learn more about the Jackson County Rebellion and why it is now being established as a historical exhibit at the state capitol. The Southern Oregon Historical Society recently announced it's the recipient of an Oregon State Capitol Foundation grant. Its award-winning new virtual exhibit, the Jackson County Rebellion, is a featured exhibit on the Oregon State Capitol website. The exhibit is based on a book written by historian Jeffrey Max Leland, which has the same title as the exhibit, The Jackson County Rebellion, A Populist Uprising in Depression-Era Oregon. Joining me in the studio to discuss the exhibit and the book are Anna Sloan. She's the curator of collections at the Southern Oregon Historical Society. Welcome, Anna.
Thanks so much for having us.
And Jeff Leland. He's the author of the book, The Jackson County Rebellion, A Populist Uprising in Depression-Era Oregon. Welcome, Jeff.
Thank you. Good to be here.
If you want to join our conversation, send an email to jx@jeffnet.org, and I'll try to get your question or comment into our conversation. So, Anna, let's start with you. Tell me about the exhibit.
Well, so this is an exhibit, as you mentioned, that we were excited to put together as part of being the recipients of a grant program that the Oregon State Capitol Foundation, they've got like a exhibiting program at the State Capitol building called the History Gateway or Capitol Gateway. And as a part of that, they allow three organizations a year to develop exhibit content that rotates through their physical building up at the Capitol, but also is featured on their website, virtual exhibits. So I think about 2 years ago now, we heard about this grant opportunity, we decided to put together a proposal, knowing that we had this really great local story to tell. This was right around the time that Jeff's book came out. So we put together our proposal, and we were lucky to be recipients of this grant program. So along with two other organizations in the state of Oregon this year, we've been able to feature our virtual exhibit on the Oregon State Capitol website. And then part two of this project is that in 2 years' time, in 2027, we have an opportunity to display a physical exhibit actually in the State Capitol building up in Salem, which we're excited about as well.
Okay, so when did this idea originate?
The grant program came across our desk, and we just thought that we had a perfect project for this. So back in, I want to say it was late 2023, early 2024, myself and also our wonderful archivist at SOHS, Jan Wright, who was a big part of this exhibit, we both received this grant announcement, and we said, let's call Jeff. Let's call Jeff and see if he's game to work on an exhibit with us.
Yeah, it was basically their brainchild to do this exhibit.
So. Well, your research, Jeff, is the seed that has grown into this new exhibit, right?
Correct.
Okay.
Or
so
my book.
Your book.
Yeah.
So what prompted you to look into this story about Jackson County?
Well, it's kind of a long story, but I've been in the Valley for almost going on 60 years, and I first became intrigued by the masthead of the Mail Tribune that was still publishing back then that said a Pulitzer newspaper on the front page. And I was always curious what that was about, and I started inquiring and learning a few things and learning more and more over the years, along with lots of other history. And then I decided to go back to school, U of O, to get a PhD in history. And I knew I wanted to do my dissertation on this topic because it had just grabbed me. I could not let it go.
Okay. So, and this is based on you finding out that the Mail Tribune won a Pulitzer for this story.
And I'd ask around. Nobody knew why. So this story that the book is about basically became lost to most people here in Oregon.
Okay, so we're going to get into that story. But, Anna, I want to just come back to you for a moment. You said that this exhibit is now on the Oregon State Capitol website as a virtual exhibit, but eventually it's going to become a physical exhibit. Tell me about this curation process.
Well, it's my joy to be able to work with all of the objects and items that we have in our collection at the Southern Oregon Historical Society. And, you know, whenever you're planning an exhibit, we always think about sort of what are the objects or pictures or items that are going to spark people to think differently about parts of the story or sort of entrance people to learn more about a specific subject. So the process of selecting items for the virtual exhibit, it was a heck of a lot of fun, I'll tell you what. Jeff and Jan and I met regularly to sort of compare notes and think about what we were thinking. Jeff was already very familiar with a lot of the items that we have in our collection at the Southern Oregon Historical Society. I'll say quickly, you know, we have a really diverse and large collection. We have historic documents, historic photographs, films, three-dimensional items, hundreds of thousands of these related to Southern Oregon history that are preserved and curated at our facilities between our archives and our three-dimensional storage. So Jeff, you know, having worked on the book, already sort of had a sense of, you know, what do we have in our collection? But it's funny how even when you sort of know what you've got, when you start looking in different little nooks and crannies, you find new things. So Jan was actually able to produce, you know, additional documents that we hadn't seen before, some new photographs. A really amazing thing that happened as part of this exhibit is, you know, once you start talking about the fact that you're doing a project, sometimes people arrive at your doorstep with materials that are relevant. I've had this happen more than once, and it's just amazing. So we have a really wonderful volunteer with our organization who had heard that we were working on this, and her late husband was part of a family that was deeply involved in newspapers in Southern Oregon. And in fact, they assumed ownership of one of the defunct papers that one of the sort of demagogues that we highlight in the exhibit had to give up as part of court proceedings. In any case, this family had a collection of newspapers from this time period just because of their own interest in the goings-on. So we received this amazing collection of not only newspapers, but also scrapbook pages where somebody had sort of looked at all of the front pages of the newspapers in Oregon and even beyond, you know, down into California, and collected clippings of the events that were happening as they were happening in the Jackson County Rebellion.
How fortunate. Someone was doing the work for you.
Yes, we love it when that happens. It's great just to see, you know, items like that. They give us a window into how people are thinking about a thing at a certain time. So what a precious item to be able to look at. So it's a combination of all of those things, items that we had in our collection that we were already familiar with, that we were able to seek out, and that came to us. And now our very fun task is going to be figuring out what items we would like to put on display for the physical exhibit, because they're going to be quite different than what's on display for the virtual, just by the nature of the media, right? A virtual exhibit is an excellent place for photographs and documents that you can sort of look at closely on a screen. But some of these more three-dimensional items we're excited to incorporate as part of the next phase of the exhibit.
Excellent. My guests are Anna Sloan. She's the curator of collections at the Southern Oregon Historical Society, and Jeff Leland. He's the author of the book, The Jackson County Rebellion, A Populist Uprising in Depression-Era Oregon. The book was the inspiration for the exhibit. So, Jeff, take us back to the early 20th century. What was happening?
Well, let's go back to the early years of the Great Depression, which is when this particular episode that the book centers on occurred. And, you know, as everyone knows, there's massive unemployment, mortgages being foreclosed, overproduction, the pear crop was allowed to, you know, they decided it wasn't worth picking and just rotted on the ground. There was lots of distress here in Southern Oregon. Out in the woods, loggers. And out of that time of stress came two individuals, one named Earl Thale, who published a weekly newspaper, and a somewhat of a newcomer named Llewellyn A. Banks, who was an orchardist down in Southern California with citrus orchards, who moved up here to take over some pear orchards, apparently a millionaire, bought an expensive house, and he started publishing his own daily newspaper. Okay. Thale's was a weekly.
So Fails is the weekly.
Yes.
And Banks is the millionaire.
Yes.
With a daily newspaper.
With a daily.
Okay, so we have rival newspapers.
Yes. They're not rivals. That's the interesting part.
Okay.
They were both colleagues and became basically a pair of demagogues, allies, against what they called the gang, the establishment, you know, the people who were, you know, kind of running things and blaming the gang, the local establishment, for all of people's troubles, and focusing on the Medford Mail Tribune, which was been around for many years, as like the voice piece, fake news, let's call it that. So things are somewhat parallel to today's in some ways.
Okay, so just to make sure I understand, you've got Fell, who is the head of a weekly.
Yes.
And you've got Banks, a millionaire, who's head of a daily. And these two are in cahoots with one another, and they don't like the established government, and they don't like the Mail Tribune.
Basically, that's correct. And they are trying to foment a political movement of dissatisfied people and take over county government.
Okay. So who's in charge of the Mail Tribune at this point?
It was published by a man named Robert Rule, who was very, very different from the two other newspaper men. Harvard graduate, prep school, et cetera, part of the East Coast establishment, but a very level-headed, moderate fellow who took it upon himself during the Ku Klux Klan period here in Jackson County to stand up against the Klan, which was doing its thing here in Oregon, focused mainly against Jews and Catholics at that time in Oregon. And he took it on the chin in terms of people stopping their subscriptions and threats against the newspaper and so on and so forth. So he had a reputation as kind of a small town crusading newspaper editor.
Okay. So now we've got some of the main characters here during this time frame.
Yes.
In the Depression era. Anna, this region was no stranger to controversy over government control back then. Even before then, back in, I think, the 1840s, 1850s, wasn't there an effort to secede? Isn't this the mythical, Jackson County's the mythical state of Jefferson, isn't it?
Well, Jeff's actually a great person to talk about that, too, and I believe that was a little bit later in time. But you're touching on something important, Mike, which is that, you know, and there's a great chapter in the book about this in a section of the exhibit on this, the fact that Southern Oregon has always been a bit of a different flavor in the state of Oregon for a number of different reasons. And part of that has to do with the specific folks who were settling here, you know, in the 1840s, 1850s. It has to do with the nature and the violence of the Rogue River Wars, right? And how how that extermination campaign against our local Native American tribes was carried out. And then, you know, as Jeff mentions, Southern Oregon has long been a place where folks, you know, a lot of the pioneers who came here were from Southern states and so had these sort of Southern mentalities that they carried with them.
The emphasis on Southern is real.
Yeah.
Yes,
it is.
Exactly, right? That's a consistent thing. And yes, all the way up until sort of the, you know, state of Jefferson movement, we can see this sort of like, yes, local discontentment, a sense of being set apart from other places in Oregon. And that really does play into how the Jackson County Rebellion came about.
Okay.
And I know that Jeff will have something to say about that too.
So Jeff, we have about a minute before we have to take a break. But tell me, what is Good Government Congress?
That was the organization formed by Earl Fell and Llewellyn Banks as a kind of a mass protest and a political movement to challenge the way things were and attempt to take over county government and have their own people in office.
Okay, that sets up the next part of our conversation very well. But we do have to take a short break. Before the break, We were talking about this good government Congress and these characters. We had Banks, who's the millionaire, of course.
Reputedly.
And so he owns a daily.
He was in major problems in the Depression himself. He was being pulled under.
Okay, so he's a desperate millionaire.
Yes, he is.
He runs a daily, and then you have Fell, who runs a weekly, and these two are media muckrakers. And you have the Standard, Mail Tribune, and that's run by a guy named Rule. And you have this good government Congress. Tell me about it.
Well, it was composed largely of Banks and Fail's readers, and they aimed their newspaper campaign against the gang at people in the rural areas of Jackson County, at working class people like the working at the Owen, Oregon lumber mill at the time, and focused on how the alleged gang, the establishment, it was basically a conspiracy trying to deprive people of almost life and limb. It was a very, very heated, incredible anger and resentment being voiced, and it really evoked a lot of response out there.
So they were stirring up the pot.
They were very much stirring up the pot.
And people were getting angry, and this turned violent.
It did.
Tell me.
It did. Well, there were, you know, kind of low-grade threats and violent, near violence on the streets of Medford. And then finally, one man made fun of the good government Congress president, a woman named Henrietta Martin, and she encountered him on the street, and her colleagues in the good government Congress pinned his arms back, and she lashed him across the face with a horsewhip. And there were fisticuffs, there were fights on the street, including one where a guy died because he hit his head against the curb. But then, not really violent, but Earl Fell and other members of the good government Congress, aided and abetted by Llewellyn Banks, there had been an election in 1932, the great election that brought about the New Deal and so forth.
That's Roosevelt?
Franklin Roosevelt. And Earl Fell was running for county judge, which is like the chair of the Board of County Commissioners.
Okay.
And it wasn't really a legal position. It was like county commissioner. And he won. He had so much support out beyond. But the good government Congress candidate for sheriff, Gordon Skimmerhorn, won, but there were questions. It was a write-in campaign involved. There were multiple candidates for sheriff. And there was a lot of question about the ballots, especially those coming in from outlying districts.
Okay, so people were questioning the vote.
Yes.
Okay.
And so there was called a recount. And the recount was objected to by Banks and Fell and the good government Congress. And the night before the recount, during a big good government Congress meeting in the courthouse auditorium, Earl Fell, after his speech in the auditorium, met with other conspirators around back of the courthouse, including Gordon Skimmerhorn, the
sheriff,
elected sheriff, apparently elected. And they broke into the vault where the ballots were kept. The courthouse was brand new. It wasn't quite finished. They were able to break a window and get to where the ballots were kept.
So these are the media muckrakers,
yes,
with the sheriff,
yes,
breaking into the Medford courthouse.
Yes. That's
okay.
True.
Go on.
And so it was a whole slew of men involved in this, and then some of the ballots were taken and thrown off the Bybee Bridge on Table Rock Road. Others were taken to burned in a bonfire near Jacksonville, and so on. It was a desperate and, let's face it, ludicrous act. But they felt they had to stop this recount because a sheriff's position gives you a lot of power.
Okay,
you can deputize people, you can let them be armed, you can arrest people, so on and so forth.
So this is about taking over the local government.
Exactly.
Okay.
And Banks and Fail were suffering because of all the outlandish conspiratorial things they'd said in their newspaper. They were being sued for libel, and they were also being sued for non-payment of debts. So they were being pulled under. So this was an act of desperation.
Okay. So the sheriff ends up dead, right?
No. That's another piece, law officer, a little later in the game. So the state police are heavily involved. The state police, Oregon State Police, was a brand new organization out to prove itself. And the governor sent down state police detectives and others to see what's happening down here and down in Jackson County, which was the subject of much news coverage throughout Oregon and across the country, actually, about what was happening here. And they soon determined who some of the ballot thieves were and got them to confess and pulled in nearly 20 people were arrested, including Earl Fail. Got out on bail. There's still investigations and so forth. And finally, they were able to tie Llewellyn Banks to the ballot theft. And he was going to be charged with criminal syndicalism.
Okay, so that's the RICO charges. He's the master syndicate.
Right.
Okay.
In a way of speaking. And the state police officer and a local law officer, George Prescott, were sent with warrants to arrest Banks on his pretty good-sized house out on West Main Street in Medford, and got up to the front porch, and Prescott knocked on the door, and Banks' wife answers the door with a burglar chain across and says he has a warrant for her husband's arrest, and here, let me show it to you. He puts his foot, so she was trying to slam the door in his face, and puts his foot between the door and the jamb, and all of a sudden, Llewellyn Banks shows up with his .30-06 hunting rifle and shoots Prescott dead there.
Boom.
On the front porch.
There it is. Does he go to jail?
Yes. He spent the rest of, after a trial in Eugene. There's no impartial jury here at that time. He was sentenced to life in state penitentiary.
Okay, so let's go over to Rule, who's running the Medford Mail Tribune. How does he win a Pulitzer?
He kept up a campaign of rationality and calm and rebutting some of the charges of Banks and Fail. And he was suffering financially from this. People would not, the supporters of Banks and Fail would not buy the Tribune, would not subscribe. They wanted only to read those two newspapers and not hear the other side at all. And so that, his standing forthright as he had against the Klan 10 years before earned him the Pulitzer Prize.
Okay. So he tells this whole story from a down, straight down the middle position that's credible and truthful.
Yes.
And he wins the.
Yes.
Okay. So where's the Pulitzer today?
We don't know. The former and last owner of the Medford Mail Tribune, whose name escapes me right now, but he was definitely not from around here. He ended up putting it up for sale. No offers he took.
You mean he put the Medford Mail Tribune up
for
sale?
Yes, he owned it lock, stock, and barrel. But when he shut down the newspaper office and everything, nobody knows what happened.
Nobody knows. So you mentioned during this time, there's this undercurrent of the KKK. White supremacy is part of this story. So tell me about the time, Anna, here. What was life like if the KKK was running everything and these muckrakers were unhappy with everything? It sounds like, the pot calling the kettle white? I don't know.
You know, yes. And I think absolutely, you know, sort of these currents of racism and xenophobia were a part of it. But what, you know, what we really see in looking at specific people's stories who were a part of the Good Government Congress, Jeff has an excellent chapter of the book. It's one of my favorite chapters where he does little profiles of members of the Good Government Congress. And it's people, you know, everyday people who—
Just ordinary people.
Just ordinary people. But people who were really going through a hard time, you know. And I think, you know, this is something that we see over and over again in history, is when you're crunched, when you can't make things work for your family, when you're feeling unable to sort of make ends meet, it's very easy to look around and blame this, that, and the other person, right? Especially if people are different from you. So that was absolutely something that, you know, a lot of these populist movements sort of took those ideas and ran with them as part of, you know, people's discontentment in terms of what was happening economically. And it was really a hard time for people. You know, we read stories and talked about stories of, you know, folks out in the hinterlands of Jackson County who were just having to go out and trap whatever animals they could find for food, who were, you know, just scraping the bottom of the barrel in terms of their resources, right? Really just desperate times.
And there was a lot of definitely, it was prohibition, so a lot of illegal moonshine making, moonshine stills out in what I call the back country during that time. And their revenue agents raided one, and one of the moonshiners, a young man named Everett Dayhack, was shot dead in that affray. And Fail made that a cause celeb in his newspaper so that people in the rural areas could really feel they were at risk.
So people are having a really tough time. They're angry. They don't like the government. You've got these muckrakers who are stirring it up, and this all becomes violent. The Medford Mail Tribune covers it all. They get a Pulitzer. And how does this all relate to today? I mean, you know, Oregon's original constitution was based on this ideology of racial hierarchy, valuing and devaluing humans by this mythological construct of race and white supremacy. So even the challenges that white people were facing here, the natives were in much worse situation, right?
Sure, absolutely. And, you know, in terms of sort of contemporary relevance, it's hard not to read the book and hard not to look at the exhibit and think, huh, some of this feels really familiar to our current moment. One of the things that we really wanted to do to sort of tease out some of those themes, just to get people to think a little bit deeper, mm-hmm. have to do with, you know, sort of exactly what you're talking about. What brings people, what are the circumstances under which people begin to question their government? And then what are the forces that can sometimes amplify that? And then, you know, we get questions about, well, so what is the role of media in all of that, mm-hmm. right? And it's very, very clear to see when you're looking at the newspapers. I mean, that is just a key to seeing part of the story. You see the language that that both, you know, all of these folks were sort of using, Banks and Fail, sort of this really, really fiery, angry, you know, as Jeff said, also conspiratorial and frankly ludicrous in some cases, language that really got people riled up in a certain direction, versus sort of the more gentle approach of the Mail Tribune. And yeah, it just brings up a lot of questions about that, and we hope people will learn something from it.
Well, we're definitely going to have to revisit this story. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have, so thank you both.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for having us.